Okay, welcome back, everybody. It is 2:20 on December 8th, 2023. We are back on the record in the matter of the appeal of the critical area buffer reduction, notice of administrative decision number 22-02629. And I believe that we are going forward with Mr. Telligens and his rebuttal witnesses.
I call back Dr. Cook.
Okay. Good afternoon, Ms. Cook. How are you today?
Good, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. All right, I swore you in a couple of weeks ago, I think, but why don't we do this again? Please raise your right hand. You swear or affirm the testimony you give today is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I do.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Telligen, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Dr. Cook. How are you doing?
Excellent.
So let's
Tired,
see.
as I'm sure all of you are.
I know. So I want to talk about mosaics. Okay. And we have heard about this concept of a mosaic throughout this case. And this was an issue that was raised, I guess, first and foremost by Ms. Bartlett. But we have heard this from now every single solitary wetlands witness on the other sides. We heard it from Ms. Bartlett. We heard it from Christopher Wright, Mr. Costers, and then we heard agreement by Mr. Heacock. And now, correct me if I'm wrong, but a mosaic of wetlands is basically a cluster of small wetlands on the landscape where they're all pretty close together, right? And the
Yes.
rule, yeah, sorry, I'll let you answer.
I
And
can't
the
just shake my head. I have, for the record, I have to respond. So, yes, that's correct.
yes. And the rule, as we got from Ms. Bartlett's report, and it's in the 2004 Wetlands Rating Manual, and it's in the 2014 Wetlands Rating Manual, is that the rule for mosaics is that every single wetland within the mosaic, in order to be a mosaic, each one of those has to be less than 1 acre in size.
Correct.
And all of those little pieces, all those smaller than 1 acre wetlands generally need to be within 100 feet of the ones next to them.
Correct.
And when it's if you have a cluster of wetlands that qualify as a mosaic, that means you group them all together and you rate them all together and they all get the same rating.
Yes, correct.
Right. And so in this case, we have been told that when Radke went out in 2007 and it did its categorization of wetland P2, it thought that P2 was part of a mosaic with L2, which is 13 acres in size. And this is what Mr. Wright said, what Mr. Koster said, what Ms. Bartlett said, and what Mr. Heacock said. And this appears to be a way of either explaining away or discrediting what Radke found in 2007 when it said wetland P2 was a category 2 wetland. Would you agree with me on that?
Yes, I would agree.
And the idea is that shattering and or exposing that error that Radke thought that wetland P2 was a mosaic means that wetland P2 should not, in fact, be rated with wetland L2. They should not be considered as being one wetland or one unit for purposes of rating, correct?
Correct.
And with that sort of illumination that they should not be considered a mosaic, Ms. Bartlett then went out and re-rated it and found that if you look just at P2 and you don't consider it part of L2, well, that little bit, that's just a category 4 and it doesn't deserve a 200-foot buffer.
That's what's been reported, yes.
Yeah. Do you know Christopher Wright?
Yes, I do.
And you used to work at Radke, right?
Yes, we didn't overlap, but I've coincided with Mr. Wright on many projects over the years, and I'm well acquainted with his work.
Okay. And is Mr. Wright somebody, in your opinion, who's a competent person?
Yes, most certainly.
And is Radke generally a competent firm?
Most certainly.
Most certainly. Are they the kind of firm that would make a mistake of thinking that a small 0.2 acre wetland like P2 is part of a mosaic with a 13 acre wetland next door?
No, from my experience, that makes no sense that the field crew and the manager who did the technical review of the report would have made that mistake twice, both in 2007 when they wrote the report, 2006 when they did the field work, and then again in 2018. So that's four times they had the opportunity to fix this. And on top of it, they didn't mention that it was a mosaic in either of those reports, but they made it clear that they knew what a mosaic was because they mentioned the fact that Q1, Q2, and 302 were mosaics. So that's more evidence that this wasn't considered a mosaic back in that time.
And let
There was
me,
another reason why they connected them.
well, yeah, well, we'll get to that. And I want to show this image too. I asked Miss Bartlett this question, and I also asked Mr. Costers this question, and I'd like to explore it with you a bit. This is a map from Radke's 2007 wetlands report. Okay, and I've added the red circles, which we'll talk about here in a moment. Now I'd be happy to show you in here, but wetland 12 in the left circle and wetland L3 in the right circle, those wetlands are also less than 1 acre in size.
Yes.
Now, and both of those wetlands are in fact 100 feet or less to wetland L2.
Yes.
Can you think of any reason? Any, even thinking about misunderstanding the code as it was written in two, or you know, the wetlands ready manuals was written in 2004 or in 2014, or at any time that between those points, that Radke could make a mistake where it thought wetland L2 was a mosaic because it didn't understand the mosaic rules, but did not think that wetland 12 or L3 were mosaics.
I can think of a couple of reasons why they would have considered L at P2 to have been connected, but none of them are because it was a mosaic.
Right. I guess my point is, if we're thinking that P2 is a mosaic, is there any reason, if you thought P2 is a mosaic, is there any
Then it
reason why you also wouldn't think L3 and Wetland 12 are mosaics?
No, they would have been included as part of the mosaic system.
Right. And in fact, they didn't think that Wetland 12 or Wetland L3 were mosaics because those were those are both rated as category threes.
Yes.
And so if Radke had thought that either of those wetlands were mosaics with L2, they would have given those a category two rating because that's what L2 got.
Correct.
Right. So Radke didn't think that P2 was a mosaic. That's not why it decided to group P2 with L2.
I
So
don't, yeah, I don't believe that that's why they decided to rate P2 with L1, L2.
Right. So let's talk about now why Radke did say that P2 is part of L2 and why it gave P2 the same rating as L2. And the place I want to start is this map.
Sorry, I have a cat chewing on a plant. That's the problem with doing
Sure.
these from our homes.
Sure. Now, there's a Radke drew a line through the middle of P2, and then it extends with arrows down into L2. Do you know what that is?
It's a stream flow if you look at the legend on the map that
Yes.
Jesus. So if
you,
included.
yeah, so if you look at the map, the symbol for streams is this. It's the sort of larger dashes with the smaller dots and the arrows. And so Radke drew a stream beginning at the top end or the east end of P2, flowing down and then into L2, correct?
Correct.
And then let's see here, we can see this a little better at 261. Here's another image they drew. Same thing. They drew a stream going down the middle of P2 into L2.
Yes, that's what
Yes.
I also see.
Yeah. Now in 2018, they don't actually show it on this particular image. But when they went back in 2018, or actually, let me just pause here. They did also show a stream going from wetland 12 into I'm sorry, wetland 12 into wetland L2. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So at least in that respect, P2 is similar to L2. But then when we jump forward to 2018, and this is, I'm sure, something Radke would have noticed in 2007 as well. But when they went back, they noticed a culvert, or they mapped a culvert between P2 and L2. Yes.
Yes. And mentioned a road also, yes.
I mentioned a road. So we know from the Radke reports, and we know from the material that's come out in this hearing, that there is a road, an old road, bisecting or separating P2 from L2, and that P2 is connected to L2 by a culvert, correct?
Correct.
Now, if we go up here to Radke's 2018 map of wetland 12, we see a surface stream channel that they mapped from 12 to L2. You see that?
Yes.
Is that consistent with there being a road between wetland 12 and wetland L2?
No.
No, because if there was a road there wouldn't be a surface stream, correct?
Correct.
Right. And so, well, they don't show it here. Well, they show it here. They show a stream channel also from L3 to wetland L2. And that also is not consistent with there being a man-made road separating wetland L3 from wetland L2, correct?
And not unless the stream's flowing over the road, correct.
Right.
Yes.
So when we're asking why did Radke think that P2 is part of L2, and how do we differentiate L2 from which they allegedly thought was a mosaic from the other wetlands, which they did not think were mosaics. At least we know that something unique about P2 is that there is a man-made feature separating it from wetland L2, right?
Correct. You
And
can even see this reflected because if you zoom in on this map, the wetland boundary for P2 at that edge is the edge of the road, and same it's a level feature for that part of L1. So you can basically see how the road goes through there, and it's also the footprint of the culvert. So it's pretty obvious right through there they were demarking the basically the outline of the road as it cut through that wetland.
Right. So you can see it visually, right? Because the western boundary of P2 follows the perimeter of that road.
Yes.
Right.
And same, you know, it's there's a flat face on that part of L1, L2 also.
Right. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do that. I meant to click on something else. So now I'd like to take us to the Kitsap County Code that was in effect when this project was vested. And this is the 2005 Kitsap County Code. It is our Exhibit A10, Madam Examiner. The same text can be found in the appendices to the development agreement, but this one's just sort of nicer formatting.
Thank you.
So I am going to go to page 32. And there is a criterion here. It is Kitsap County Code section 19 dot 200 dot 210 subsection D. And it's this one right here. And it's called criteria for determining wetlands divided by man-made features. Okay. And so I'm just going to read this provision and we're going to trip through it a little bit. All right. So first in subsection D1, it says, when a wetland is divided by a man-made feature, e.g., a road embankment, the wetland shall be rated if as if it is not divided, if there is a perennial or intermittent surface water connection between the two wetlands, and either of the following criteria is met. And I just want to stop there for a second. Now, in our case, unlike the other wetlands, P2 is in fact separated from L2 by a man-made feature.
Yes.
And now we should ask, right, if we were applying this criteria, we should ask, is there a perennial or intermittent surface water connection between the two of them, correct?
Yes, there is. There's a culvert that connects the P2 with L1.
Right. And so if we go back to Radke's map from 2007, we can see Radke thought there was a perennial or surface water connection between P2 and L2 because it shows the stream going from P2 into L2, correct?
Correct.
Right. Now we have some other evidence that there is a surface water connection between P2 and L2. And let's see. Just one, give me one second. So this is exhibit R33. These are Miss Bartlett's photographs that she took of wetland P2. And were you here for her testimony?
Yes, I was.
Okay. So I'm looking at her second photograph right here. And this is one that I specifically asked her about. And now and this photograph is of the eastern end of P2, the one closest to the spine road. And her caption says that the photo two is taken from within the gully down to wetland P2 and is looking east, back up the slope toward the east property line. And she says the photo documents the lack of a channel or evidence of surface water flow. Okay. And I asked her about this feature right here. I'll put my rectangle around it. And I'll ask you the same question. What do you notice about this particular area of the photograph?
That is an eroded channel.
And tell and why is that? I mean, we can all see it with our eyes, but what is it about this image that tells you that is an eroded channel?
It's etched out. It's deeper in elevation than the other areas, and there are leaves that appear to have flowed with the water down that channel. They were collected in the surrounding areas. This is the she's calling it a gully. The previous person who just testified called it a trough, but this wetland is located in a trough, and this is clearly an eroded channel within that trough. And this would have likely been what Radke identified as a stream channel when they mapped the wetland.
Okay.
And it's consistent with the definition of a slope wetland too. They flow in one direction, downhill, and you often will find channels in slope wetlands where, depending on how much water they collect and how much water discharges into them.
Right. Fair enough. So that's sort of evidence of surface flow into the east end of P2, right? But we're interested in if there is a surface connection between P2 and L2. So I'm going to jump to photograph 8 of this document. This is Miss Bartlett's photograph of the outfall from the culvert. Okay. It says photo 8 shows the outlet of the culvert, which is 12
Objection.
Inches in diameter.
We did not enter these photos into the record as exhibits, nor did we provide any testimony with regards to this photo 8.
Yes, sustained. I was wondering that when this picture came up.
So, Madam Examiner, it's very critical that we find out why Radicky determined that P2 is part of L2. And the applicant gave us these documents. And this photograph shows that there was water flowing into P2. And so they've had a chance to review it. They voluntarily sent it to me. They annotated it for us. I think in all fairness, we ought to be able to present this to show what the culvert looks like as it comes out of P2.
Right. I do find that even though it was not introduced by the applicant, it is introduced without surprise to show or to rebut Ms. Bartlett's testimony. So I will allow questions on this photograph.
I just like to state for the record that we were not allowed to present evidence regarding the culvert earlier over the objections of Mr. Tullegen with regards to it not being rebuttal. I just need to say that for the record here, that there, I think there's some significant equity is going on at this point in the proceeding with regards to use of these photos.
Fair enough. But it wasn't this exhibit. It was the survey of the culvert that I had objected to. It wasn't any of the photographs. But in any event, so Dr. Cook, this is a photograph of the outfall of the culvert. Okay. I'm going to ask you something about some of these features. First of all, can you tell me what this feature is right here? Sort of a line separating a lighter portion from a darker portion.
It appears to be a water line, a water elevation line that is consistent across seasons so that it leaves a mark on the surface.
Okay. And is a water line, in my lay understanding, does it form just if water goes through once?
No, that's it. That's what I'm saying. If there's a consistent elevation of water, it will leave a mark on a tree, on a rock, in this case, on a culvert, and showing where a consistent water elevation is for longer than a single time.
I see. And we see, what do you notice about what's on the bottom of this culvert?
There appears to be quite a bit of small gravel and also debris, but soil and gravel.
Okay. And how would soil, gravel, and debris get into the culvert?
It would have been carried from wetland P2 with water. And it would have been a significant amount of water at a certain high enough velocity to have carried stones and pebbles.
I see. Now, I asked Ms. Bartlett if she were interested in figuring out if water flowed through this culvert, what would she do? She told me she would go back and check in winter or in spring. Has anybody testified that you've heard in this case that they've gone out to check this culvert in winter or spring to see if there was water flowing through it?
No. That
okay.
certainly would have solved the question once and
right.
for all, but it's not been done.
Yeah. And is a culvert, now this is not a culvert that is buried underground, this is a culvert that's laid on the surface. Would this be considered a surface water connection?
Yes.
Yes. It's covered, right, but it's not underground.
Correct.
Right. So if we go back to the 2007 code to which this project vested, we see here a first criterion, a wetland is divided by a man-made feature, e.g. a road embankment, which we have. The wetland shall be rated as if it is not divided if there is a perennial or intermittent surface water connection between the two wetlands, right? We have evidence, do we not, that there is in fact at least an intermittent surface water connection between wetlands P2 and L2.
I believe that's correct.
Right. So let's then go down to criterion D1A. So once you have a wetland separated by a man-made feature, and you have a surface, at least an intermittent surface water connection between the two, now we ask an additional question. We ask whether it can be demonstrated that the separate wetlands were one discrete wetland prior to construction of the man-made feature. This may be accomplished through an analysis of secondary information such as aerial photographs and soil maps. Has anybody, to your knowledge in this case, attempted to figure out if wetland P2 and wetland L2 used to be the same by producing soil maps?
No.
How about aerial photographs?
No.
Okay. Let's go back to the 2018 Radicke map. Just one second. Now, you had testified previously that you thought wetland P2 and L2 used to be part of the same wetland. Can you tell us again why that is?
Well, there's multiple reasons. One is if you just look at the mapping, it's fairly clear that they're all one system. That's because the only reason that it doesn't go from that point on P2 across to the point on L1 is the presence of the road. And they mapped the wetland boundaries for P2. They followed the edge of the road, and the same for L1, L2. So there's clearly a culvert. Everyone admits there's a road in there. And slope wetlands flow unidirectional. They showed there's a stream that flows between P2 and L1. And on top of that, I've seen photographs both from Ms. Bartlett and Mr. Lubisher from the field that looks to me like even the roadbed on either side of the culvert is reverting back to wetland conditions. There are wetland plants that have come back. And they keep in the photos, they show the margin, which has the sword fern, which is the upland plant, but all the plants that are growing just adjacent to that culvert are all wetland plants. They're facultative. There's salmonberry, there's pigback, there's nettle. Every one of them is a facultative plant. And the soils, the fill that everyone's reported that's in that area is a sandy soil that was placed on what would have been on top of the wetland. And it's extremely dark in color. And it appears to me to be in the process of becoming wetland soil if it's not already, although that takes, tens, if not hundreds or thousands of years to form, but it's gotten extremely dark. So any of you who think of sand, which would have been what they used as fill material, is kind of orangey colored, and the soil in Ms. Bartlett's photograph from the other day, it's almost as black as the soil that she showed from the soil pit that she dug in wetland P2.
Fair enough.
So that to me, it's more than indicates that they were connected at one point in time.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Now we have heard another theory. We have heard a theory that instead of P2 and L2 being one wetland with a road that was bulldozed through the middle of them, that in fact what may have happened is that the road was bulldozed through, and that had the incidental effect of creating wetland P2. What is your response to that theory?
That theory came from Mr. Heacock, and I don't think he's a soil scientist. If you look at the soils in P2, and again, Ms. Bartlett showed a really excellent photo of a soil pit in P2, it's extremely dark in color. That is the result of chemical reactions that occur in wetlands. Not this, yeah, that one, that occur in wetlands, and they occur in the absence of oxygen, which means that the soils are saturated. And it's caused by both the elemental iron in mineral original mineral soils. We have a lot of iron in our soils. Elemental iron is a black blue in color. Oxidized iron, which means there's not saturated conditions, which means it's upland, is bright orange. That's what rust is. And secondary, the organic acids that have also colored this soil are a result of they're extremely black, and they're mostly what stains our soils in the Pacific Northwest. And they take hundreds of years to accumulate. So you don't just get black soils like this, and especially with as much organic composition as there is, in just by the turn of the century. This isn't a decades process, long process. This is an extremely long process. So this wetland P2 has been here for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. And any
Okay.
soil scientist who knows about soil formation processes, and I'd spent more years studying this than I care to admit, will know that this doesn't just happen overnight. It doesn't happen in decades. So this is an old soil. It's been around a long time.
Right. And so for the record, what we're looking at here and what you've been describing is photograph 5 of Miss Bartlett's packet, and it shows the soil profile revealed in her wetland P2 test plot. So this is her digging in wetland P2. And your testimony, if I understand it, is that what we can look at the soil and see, if we were soil scientists, is that this is not a soil that would have formed since the road was bulldozed.
Correct.
Okay. So back to the code. We have a wetland divided by a man-made feature. There is, in fact, evidence of an intermittent surface water connection between the two. And we do have an instance in which it appears very strongly that wetland P2 and L2 used to be one wetland before the road was constructed, correct?
Correct.
So now, if we go back, well, actually, before we go that back, let's look at the second one. And it says the two separated well, I guess. Is the alternative, right? Either you show that they used to all be one wetland, or you can also meet the criterion if you can show the two separated wetlands can be shown to function as one wetland. And that this shall be determined based on normal conditions, i.e., in the absence of unauthorized activity, the wetlands possess similar vegetative or wildlife assemblages or hydrologic regimes. Do wetland P2 and L2 possess or have similar vegetative communities?
Yes, and all the photos that I've seen from both the Radke reports, the Joanne Bartlett reports, and from Mr. Lubacher, the vegetation is almost identical between that part of L1, L2, and wetland P2. And I will also add that's coming back into the Skid Road bed, that's the vegetation that's reappeared up through the Skid Road bed. It's all basically the same vegetation.
Okay, and how about would you expect them to have similar wildlife assemblages?
Because it's basically 20 feet apart from where P2 ends and L1 begins, wildlife is the mostly mobile, and they would be able to pass back and forth between those areas. The culvert is not so high that, other than maybe some little tiny voles and moles, they would be able to get over that little mound. And certainly deer and larger mammals and amphibians would be able to hop between those two areas. So yes, wildlife would also be contiguous across.
And what about hydrologic regimes?
And hydrologically, the culvert's there. So for surface water flows, it would go there. And for groundwater flows, it would just flow between the two underneath. Again, it's only a 20 feet foot separation, so
Right.
they'd be contiguous. So functionally, P2 would ha it has been identified as a slope wetland by everyone. P2 would have been the source of hydrology for that near area of wetland L1. So hydrologically, P2 would have fed L1,
right.
You know, historically, and still does, as far as we can see.
So if we go back to our map of Radicke 2007, If we go back to our map of Radicke 2007, and we were looking at this map, and we were to assume that the people who did the Radicke report, that they are highly credentialed, that they know the code, that they know that wetlands 12, P2, and L3 are all similarly sized, similarly situated to L2. They know that P2 is in fact separated by a man-made feature and a culvert. That is the one thing that makes it unique. Is it more likely that they thought just P2 was a mosaic and not the other ones? Or is it more likely that they knew the facts and they knew the code and they were simply applying the code?
The latter. I just cannot imagine that Radicke would have made that mistake. Not just once, not just twice, but four times. The field crew would have had to misidentify that wetland and not counted it as connected. The manager who did the tech review on the report would have had to make the mistake and say that it was a mosaic, which clearly it's not. And it would have had to have been repeated again in 2018. And that just seems highly unlikely to me.
Right. And now the code section that we were just looking at, that is still the code section that applies today for this project. It is still the code section that applies to P2, because that's what they are vested to. In your opinion, does P2 meet the requirements of that code section such that it ought to, under the code, be combined with wetland L2 and given the same rating?
I think that there's no question that it applies. I don't think that's a stretch at all. It fits the definition of that part of code perfectly.
Right. Okay. Very good. So now that's what Radicke did in 2007. They applied the code. But there are other reasons why one might either find that wetland P2 should be included with L2 for purposes of rating, or at least you would want to do more investigation to find out. I want to go through some of those with you as well. The first one has to do with the Army Corps of Engineers 1987 Wetlands Delineation Manual. And can you tell me what that document is, generally speaking?
It's the protocol that wetland delineators were required to use back at that time. And we have an additional manual now that's called a supplement, but it basically reproduces the same language and the same protocol. And we're required to look at certain features in the landscape with respect to vegetation, soils, and hydrology. And it outlines exactly what those are.
Right. Now, when Ms. Bartlett was giving her testimony, I asked her a hypothetical. I asked her, suppose I were the owner of wetland L2, and I just sort of plowed a road to the middle of wetland L2, destroying the features that make it a wetland. I asked her, would that still be the area that I plowed through? Would that still be considered a wetland? And she said she didn't know. And so I'm going to go here in this document to page 84. And this section of the manual refers to quote unquote atypical situations. Can you tell me generally what atypical situations are?
It's when there's been some sort of disturbance, either man-made or natural, that is made one or more of those three criteria I discussed not present. So there's a predominance of evidence that it's something is a wetland, but let's say the vegetation indicators are missing, or the soil's been filled, so the soil's indicators are missing, or someone's blocked off the hydrology at least temporarily. So that's missing. So you think it's wetland, but it's been disturbed.
I see. So in other words, you know, if I go out there and I plow a road through L2 and I don't get an Army Corps of Engineers permit or the right county permits, I don't just get out of jail free. I have to face the consequences because that area is still a wetland.
Yes. It's right. It's a way of capturing situations like that. Yes.
Right. And so we have here under the first section, it talks about unauthorized activities. And it says unauthorized discharges requiring enforcement actions may result in removal or covering of indicators of one or more wetland parameters. Examples include, but are not limited to, alteration or removal of vegetation, placement of dredged or fill material over hydric soils, and or three, construction of levees, drainage systems, and the like. Now, I asked Ms. Bartlett if she knew whether that road had gotten any sort of necessary approval to go through the wetland, and she didn't know that. Now, assuming that we don't know, would that be a relevant thing to inquire into when asking whether or not the area between wetland P2 and L2 is still a wetland?
Yes, that would be one of the questions that I would ask.
And what are some of the other questions?
Timing on it, timing on when the activity occurred, if there's any aerial photographs that show before and after this activity happened, setting up groundwater wells to see and surface water measures through the culvert to see if there's water flowing. I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can look at to see if something's occurred in an area that looks like it's not pristine, as it were.
Would it be possible to drill down through the road to see if there are wetland soils beneath it?
Yes. And one of the things that in atypical situations, one of the protocols that they ask us to do is to go below a buried layer. So if fill has been placed in an area on top of the pre-disturbance soil elevation, you're asked to go down and look at the soils below that buried layer.
I see. And so in this case, jumping back, you know, to the question of did wetland P2 used to be connected to wetland L2, we could theoretically, or someone could theoretically, go out there and drill down through the road to see if there are hydric soils beneath it.
Yes.
Do you know if anybody's done that?
No, nobody's done that. The geotech did some soil pits, but one of the problems with that is that geotechs look at the deeper at stratigraphy, and it does them. Their reports seldom help wetlands people because we're mostly interested in the very top layers, and they kind of throw those away as unimportant. And so their reports often will identify the top 12 inches or so as duff or, you know, surface layer, and we don't get a color. We often don't get a soil texture, et cetera.
Right. So in a geotech report, you wouldn't get, for example, you know, 3 feet below the surface is 10YR2/3.
Yeah, you don't get the information that we need as wetland delineators for it to be useful. So, but as far as I know, Radicke and Bartlett have not done that investigation. They did not go below the fill in the road.
Right.
At least it's not been documented.
Yeah, it's at least not been documented. Now, so that's a sort of a second reason why LP2 could be connected to L2, even to this day, because the road that goes through them was never permitted properly, and it just ended up destroying a wetland. And so under the atypical situations of the Army Corps of Engineers manual, that area should and ought to still be considered a wetland. Madam Examiner, by the way, I'd ask to admit this exhibit. This is Exhibit A4.
Okay. Ms. Liao?
No objections.
Okay. Thank you. A4.
And then the final sort of reason why you might think that, I guess today, even if not back in 2007, who knows about 2007, but at least today, why you might think that wetland P2 should still be conglomerated with or grouped with or united with wetland L2 for rating purposes, is that even if that area between them if wetland indicators had been destroyed in the past, they might have regenerated. Right?
Yes.
And now we've heard a lot about how wetland ratings and wetland delineations are only good for 3 to 5 years, right? We've heard that from the developers, witnesses, as a rationale for why Ms. Bartlett went back out just in October of this year to recategorize wetland P2. We heard this morning from Mr. Heacock that he asked Ms. Bartlett to go out and redelineate wetland P2 when he asked her to reevaluate it. To your knowledge, has anybody since 2018 redelineated wetland P2?
No, they've only re-rated it.
And that was more than 5 years ago.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, the re-rating was done recently, but yes, the delineation was done. And at the time in 2018, they just verified that the boundaries were still, so they didn't do a new delineation. So, I mean, it basically hasn't been delineated since 2006 when the original field work was done.
I see. Okay. So let's look at the area. Let's see here. So I did ask Ms. Bartlett a question about this photograph of her exhibit 33. This was her test plot that she dug in the road area, separating P2 from L2. What does this image tell you?
It appears to me to either be full-on wetland or area that is in the process of converting to wetland. The vegetation, which reacts rather quickly, is all wetland plants. It's mostly piggyback with a little bit of nettle and a few canes of salmonberry. And I do see sword fern, which is an upland plant, but again, as we've seen, that P2 trough is surrounded by sword fern in the up, you know, just on the margin in the upland. And the soils look extremely dark to me. I can tell it's a sandy texture, but it's very dark. So as I described earlier, sand that's upland, that's just fill, is usually rust colored. You know, we think of sand on a beach and it's kind of orangey in color. That's from the oxidized iron. And this is a far cry from that. And our most common upland soils are gravelly sandy loams. And those are quite orange. They have a very high sand content and they're quite orange. And again, this is the furthest thing from that. It's very, very dark. Mm-hmm. And as I said, it's either very close to being a wetland soil or it would meet the criteria. Now, it looks to me like we talked about the chroma earlier, and that's how the intensity of the darkness. If it's a chroma of 1, it's automatically a wetland soil. If it's a chroma of 2, it has to have other, what we call redoxomorphic features, which means there has to be other indicators that are present that indicates that it's wetland. And I'd need to know whether or not there were other features to make this soil actually hydric. But the fact that it's in a roadbed almost makes it moot because we know that it's been filled but it does look to me like it's in the process of converting back to being wetland, even though they filled the road.
And this is just one. So a couple things. This is just one point.
Right. And we don't know if it's actually in the old footprint of where P2 and L1 were connected, or if she's just on the other side and she didn't know either. So I don't know if this is actually in that area, but it's probably pretty close. Given that it's got a prevalence of wetland plants,
right, and nor were we given any with the other. So, for example, earlier in these proceedings, we looked at data sheets for test pits when they were going back to reevaluate Q1, Q2, and it talked about the chroma and it talked about the hydrology and the vegetation. We could actually see the data they collected. We don't have that here, right?
No, we don't have that here.
But if we were interested in whether or not any part of that road area between has turned I guess now exhibits wetland characteristics, what would we want to do? We would want to do test pits throughout the whole area, right?
Yeah, and because it's fill, you'd want to go below the fill.
Okay. All right. I'm going to go to photograph 6 in this set. This is a photograph that she has where it says, photograph 6 shows the area of the old road where the upland test plot was conducted. The visible vegetation includes salmonberry, youth on age, and stinging nettle. This photograph is looking westerly across the old road toward wetland L1, L2, which is downslope beyond the salmonberry in the background. What does this look like to you?
Looks like wetland again. It's the exact same vegetation that I see in the photos from L1, L2, and very similar to the photos I see for quite a bit of wetland P2.
Okay. So, given that this hasn't, P2 has not been redelineated since 2006, and given how much information we've gotten from the applicant and the county about how delineations and ratings are only good for 5 years, based on that and based on these photographs, would you recommend that maybe someone should go back out and redelineate wetland P2 and figure out if they're even connected today?
Yes. I think it was jumping the gun on re-rating it as a separate wetland.
Right. Very good. So ultimately, let me see here. What do we know? We know that wetland P2 is not a mosaic. We know that it was rated properly with L2 under the existing code to which this project is vested. And we know that even putting that aside, there are grounds for going out and redelineating P2 to see if it is connected today on the surface based on evidence provided by the applicant's wetlands expert.
Well, if it's vested, then I'm not sure. I'm not even sure it's salient what current conditions are if the project is vested to the previous code. It should
right.
be vested to what the conditions were back then. But this is helping us see if the fact that the wetland is reestablishing itself, that it's still connected hydrologically, because the plants are reacting to the fact that there's water still flowing between that 20 feet between P2 and L1, and the soils are showing that it's continually saturated and they're getting very dark, and the hydrology is obviously present. Mm-hmm. So it's what current conditions are telling us is what may have been missing back then, because there's been a lot of years between then and now and of not being disturbed. It's just adding credence to the fact that back then it was wetland, and it's still, that they were connected, save for somebody shooting the skid road through them.
Right. I'm just going to close my screen share because I had forgotten to write down a page number. So let me just find it here really quick. There we go. So I want to jump horses now a bit to, let's see here, stop share. To the Miss Bartlett's test plot sheets for when she went back to look at Q1, Q2, and 302. This is her test plot 14. And she said that soils were not present. Do you see that?
Yes.
I just want to go over this one more time. So on her test sheets, where she says there was a chroma of 1, that's automatically a wetland soil, correct?
Yes, by definition in the manual.
Okay. And we had some discussion about Redox features. And there was a and you had talked about how Redox features, there are certain rules for when they're over 5%, but your point was that the human eye cannot distinguish between 1 and 5. So if you see any present, it's probably 5, right?
Especially in these very dark soils, yes, because the darkness masks the presence of those redox features. But
Right.
yes, that's
And
correct.
where did you learn that from?
I've taken a couple of, well, one, I have a PhD in soils, and I spent most of the 15 years I was a graduate student also being a wetlands consultant, so I could afford grad school. And so there's that. And then I've taken two classes from the man that wrote the wetland indicator manuals. So that comes from directly from him and papers that he showed us, which at the time. So yes. I've been questioned about this 1%. Why is it one of the indicators that when you read the definition of, for example, indicator A11, why does it say 1 to 2% if you can't visually see it? Well, technically, if you've got a wetland that's a chroma of 2, and that this is when you need these additional indicators that it's showing here. You collect a sample and do a laboratory analysis, and the lab can identify those redoxymorphic features. What do doing lab tests, you can spectrophotometer can see them, and you can do some chemical tests that will identify any oxidized iron and sulfur and manganese, et cetera, in the soil profile. So you don't have to see them for them to be present.
And so I believe this was testimony from Mr. Wright when he was asked about this. He said, "Well, it's in the it's in the field indicator guide, right? Sometimes you do things when it's 5, sometimes you do things when it's 1, sometimes you do things when it's 2. So there's obviously a different. Therefore, the human eye must be able to distinguish these things, but that's not in fact true,
No, that's
right?
not true.
You do different things at different redox features." Or it sometimes will distinguish from 1 to 5 because people take it back to the lab and look at it, right?
Correct.
Right. Did Miss Bartlett ever say she took these soils back to the lab?
No. In fact, most consultants don't.
Right.
No.
Okay. One last point. She did her test plots on April 1st, and then some of them were earlier. Let's see, in at the end of March, I believe it was March 24th. There we go. March 24th. Is that a good time to look for redox features?
Okay, this is another thing that I need to clarify because of testimony that was said. There are different optimal times for different features of when you're doing wetlands delineation. The core manual in general states that you should not do a delineation outside of the growing season. And in the Pacific Northwest or West Side Washington State, that can vary from kind of mid-March to kind of mid-April, depending on the year. But it's basically when plants start to bloom and the organisms in the soil, which mediate those chemical reactions in the soil, wake up. It's warm enough for them to live and thrive and perform those chemical reactions or mediate those chemical reactions. So from a perspective of so
Dr. Cook, I'm sorry to interrupt. Ms. Liao has her hand up. I was just alerted by the hearing examiner clerk. And I'm so sorry to interrupt, but
I apologize. I think that was an error. I think I pushed.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. Thank
Yeah,
you.
I was confused. All right. Sorry
Okay.
to interrupt you, Dr. Cook. Please continue. I messed you up there.
No worries. So from a perspective of soils, in the winter when it's been raining, it's really hard to read soils. It's hard to read their colors. It's hard to read their textures, etc., because they're just so darn wet. In the early part of the growing season, especially if there's a herbaceous component in the understory and for the trees and shrubs that haven't started to bloom, the veg indicators are missing. And they don't, for herbaceous things, they often don't come up until kind of the end of April, beginning of May. And so you might only have the trees, so you're missing the whole understory, which could be the dominant. I mean, I've had projects where I delineated in the winter against my better judgment and then went out in the spring, and the whole understory was skunk cabbage. And they were growing outside of my delineation line. So that's one of the reasons why I now refuse to do delineations in the winter. And then, so the veg is much better done kind of May, June, July. But then you get into the point towards the end of the season where a lot of the stuff has died back. So you kind of need to cut that off before it dies back in the fall. So the fall and winter for the veg and early spring, it's not good. For the hydrology, one of the things that people like to do is go out in the early part of the spring because there's water there. And if your hydrology is not present in the, again, July, August, September, that's not the best time to do it from a hydrology perspective. So, hitting a wetland that is not really obvious is great if you can hit it at those different times of year because the different indicators are at their peak or either present or absent at other times of the year. So there it's not a there's an optimal time. Well, maybe May and June would kind of be optimal because it's still raining here at that time, but we don't often have the luxury of doing it at those times. But there are times that you definitely shouldn't go out. And again, I follow the recommendations in the delineation manual, which has recommended times for different indicators.
Okay, but I guess I'm just confused. How would the time of year affect what the soils look like?
Well, it's soils and hydrology because and I've had a lot of pushback that some of the indicators that I identify are hydrology indicators, but they're indicators of chemical reactions that are occurring in the soils as a result of water being present. So if, for example, those redox accumulations, we used to call them mottles, they're little and oxidized rhizospheres, which are a rusty coat around root channels. That's a chemical reaction that occurs in the soils in the water when water's present. And it's counted as a hydrology indicator, but it's a chemical reaction. Chemical reactions in and of themselves are not part of hydrology. So in this earliest part of the spring, again, you have some nights where it's freezing again, and it may warm up during the day, but you've got bacteria and fungi in the soils that are mediating these activities. And so if they're not awake yet or they're not really reactive, those kinds of things are not going to be obvious in the soils. They're not going to be present yet.
I see.
From a soil perspective, it's not great to go out. And again, I also said in the winter, a lot of our soils look hydric, and it's because they're very saturated. Even trying to sample sometimes, if the groundwater is at high elevation, you try to dig a hole and it fills with water, and all the soil falls back into it. So it's that time of year is not the best for reading soils either. So timing is important also from a soils perspective.
I see. And when you say chemically active, you mean sort of produces a chemical reaction of biological activities, like
Yeah, but
things living in the dirt.
the soil microbiome is just as important as the mineralogy when it comes to reading a soil with respect to whether or not it's a wetland soil. It they because they mediate all the chemical reactions that occur in soils.
I see.
And so those all those things that happen, the accretions, precipitation of manganese and iron that we read as part of indicators in soil, they all happen because the soil microbes make them happen.
And you, in your answer, you also talked about how there's like sort of different times of the year that might be optimal for one, one criterion, but not another, right?
Right.
And
Yes.
we've heard a lot in this proceeding about how wetland ratings and delineations are sort of snapshots in time, right?
Correct.
Like the person goes out and just clicks their camera, and then that's what determines everything. But wouldn't it be more accurate to say that sometimes delineations and ratings are based on an accumulation of snapshots, right?
Yes.
We'll take a snapshot here, we see something we're concerned about, we might go back and take another snapshot at a different time of the year, and then slowly build up a real picture.
Yes, that's accurate.
Benefits of buffers. We heard testimony from Mr. Wright that part of the buffer might be for water quality, part of the buffer might be for wildlife, etc. But I just have to ask you, is one of the benefits of a buffer maintaining the hydrological and hydrogeological conditions that would allow groundwater or other waters to continue to feed the wetland?
Yes.
And how
And
so?
it's not just feeding. Well, the hydrology happens. There's a lot of ways that hydrology happens to in the landscape to influence wetlands. One is direct falling, rainfall falling on wetlands. Another is rainfall falling in a contributing basin and flowing by surface flow to a wetland. And third is rainfall falling, percolating down through the soil, going into the groundwater, and then feeding the wetland via groundwater. So any disturbance, it's not just a matter of replacing the vegetation. It's a matter of the reason why, and again, this is all part of best available science, which the Department of Ecology has a document called Wetland Buffers, State of the Science. It's a little old at this point, but a lot of the science hasn't changed, and we haven't found all these new great discoveries about buffers. We know that soils can be disturbed. They that you know it's not just the microbiome that I talked about. The water, the soils are what mediates how quickly water from the sky ends up to downstream receiving waters. And it can, as it perks through the soil profile, if you compact that or you remove overburden layers, it can change that residence time tremendously. This P2, for example, P2 is a groundwater-fed wetland. If you disturb the basin upstream, it's the shallow groundwater because it's clearly very shallowly groundwater-fed, not deep groundwater-fed. Maybe the western portion of P2, but the upland portion of P2 was formed from a very, very shallow groundwater. And that's why it's there. If you get rid of the contributing basin just adjacent, that water's not going to be there. So the whole eastern part of P2 could go away. You compact it so that it's becomes surface water. What's discharging in P2 now is the shallow groundwater. If you're taking that away, you're not going to have that shallow groundwater discharge right at the eastern edge of P2. So, and then this could all affect the receiving part of which would be the eastern part of L1, L2, just adjacent to P2 that could affect that too. So yes, you can compact, you can, as the geotech said earlier, you can actually take away a restricting layer that allows deeper infiltration so that you no longer have shallow groundwater. There's all kinds of things that you can do, but the main idea is that you should leave it intact, because any kind of disturbance, unless you do a lot of studies, you're not going to know exactly how it's going to impact the wetland that's just adjacent. And that's why the recommendations are do not disturb buffers.
And you not only have a PhD in soils, you also have education and training in geology.
Yes, I have my undergraduate degrees in geology.
And so what do you make of Ms. Decker's statement that P2 is fed by deep groundwater?
I don't think that's accurate. And I clearly it shows that it's not accurate, because the whole eastern lobe of P2 wouldn't be there if it wasn't fed by shallow groundwater. Where did that water come from? It's too small a contributing basin to have formed a wetland just from precipitation that falls on it. So, and there's now a development that people have reported is feeding water into that little trough-like area. But historically, and I've already established it's a very old wetland, judging from the soils, that wasn't there historically. So it has to be a where groundwater emerges right at the eastern elevation, the very beginning of P2. It has to be very shallow groundwater, not 9 feet deep, 10 feet deep. And it's one of the things geotechs don't look at, but we wetland biologists do. We look at the top 1 to 2 feet, and they just think of it as a burden and an annoyance. But that's what we look at, and that's what's clearly feeding that top end. And the shallow groundwater emerges at that eastern end, becomes surface water, and then flows down through, because there's channels. We've seen that. So, and it was identified back in 2006 when they were in the field, and verified again in 2018 when they again established that there's a stream down through that wetland. So
Right.
yeah, it's I think that disturbing that the in the areas where those test pits were from the geotech, it clearly it's not just deep groundwater, it's a shallow groundwater which is slated to be removed.
Very good. Thank you so much, Dr. Cook. I have no further questions for you.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to ask if we can take a 10-minute break at this time before we head into cross-examination. 3:33, so why don't we just come back at 3:45?
Yeah. Sure.
Great. Thank you.